Hey everyone, it's been a while since I did a behind the scenes post, and y'all have been very graciously patient with that, so I thought I'd finally get something going again. And as you can see, the format for this is a bit of a, well, it's like a podcast. I've done one podcast in my life. My friend Charlie interviewed me about living and working in Japan. So I don't expect to be super smooth, but I hope to deliver the points and concepts I want to express as clearly and smoothly as I can. In my videos, of course, what you hear, the script, is something that I've been working on for a long time. I've been researching the material for a while. And then the script is a distillation of what I thought were the most interesting points, and then delivered as succinctly and, balanced with interesting anecdotes, delivered in a very curated way. So this will be a little bit different, but this first one might be a little rocky, but hopefully enough of y'all get enough value from this that I can keep doing this, so that I can keep doing this and give you more insights on other things. But for now, what I was thinking of was giving you some insight into my writing process. So the writing process is, I want to say, the most difficult. Yeah, it's easily the most difficult part of the entire process. So my process starts with research, which is more of a passive thing. I'm usually just kind of researching various topics all the time that I'm interested in, or that I think could be interesting, or that are worth exploring. And it's just something that I do in my day-to-day. I'll be traveling from one place to another and listening to an audiobook or a podcast, or when I wake up in the morning, I usually, for those of you interested in my morning routine, I usually wake up, sometimes I'll jump up and down. I got that from my friend. It seems to get my blood flowing, maybe get some lymph moving around, and just feel a little more awake. And then I'll either do that or I'll stretch. Lately, it feels like my back and my neck are just always tight. So I do this, I don't know what you call it. It's a yoga pose where you're laying on your stomach, and then you push your hands up so your back curves backward. I'll do that a couple times. And then I'll meditate and then watch some lecture for about 25 minutes, something that is relative to the channel or could be relative to the channel. And then I'll exercise, get showered, and head out to my working space to start working. But anyways, so like as I mentioned now, I'll watch a lecture in the morning. And that'll just be about anything that I think could be relevant to the channel. And then I'll keep that in my head for later. So the process doesn't actually start with, oh, I'm going to do a video on this topic, so let me start researching it with the end goal of having a video. It's more like at some point I'll just kind of come across a couple different really interesting points on this or that topic, and then I start to think like, hey, I think I know enough about this topic, and I've recently come across some very interesting points, so I think that this topic could make for an interesting video. And then I'll do the more directed research. So I will have a couple ideas, an idea for the thesis for the video, or an idea for the flow of the video. But then of course it's not totally complete. I can't just write it off the top of my head. So I have to say, I have this concept, how can I connect these to make an interesting narrative? And then I'll have to fill in the gaps, my gaps in knowledge with more directed research. Or maybe I'll have a point and I'll think, I think maybe this is the reason for, the reason for this concept, or the mechanism behind this concept, I think I have an idea what it is, but I need to confirm and have research to support what I'm saying. So then I get into the directed research. And the writing process and the directed research are kind of happening at the same time. No, that's not quite right. So the directed research happens first, And then I'll get to a point where I'm like, okay, yes, I think I can make a very solid narrative expressing these concepts, and it'll open like this and conclude like this. And then I'll start writing. But of course, as I'm writing, I'll start to, you know, I'll type something out. I'm like, and I'll say, I don't think I can quite say that. Or I don't know if this figure is accurate. Or this needs a figure. I don't have a number for this or a statistic for this. So I better find one. And so as I'm writing, the directed research kind of comes up. But the writing process is, the most mentally draining, I would say. And then comes the narration. That's not too hard. It's just sometimes, like, for now, for example, I'm drinking some tea. I stopped drinking coffee a while back. I feel significantly better off of coffee. And so I've been drinking black tea. I think I'd feel better without any caffeine, but what are you going to do? So I'm drinking some tea, and it kind of dries my mouth out. So I feel like if I was using my better mic, it would be picking up all these little, like, smacking noises. Hopefully this microphone's not picking up, like, smacking noises in my mouth. Like, I can't really emulate them for you now, and I don't think you'd want me to. Or sometimes it's just kind of like, how should I put it? The condition of my voice sometimes will dictate whether I can get through a narration session very smoothly or not. So that process it's not too bad. And then the editing process, I actually really enjoy that. I think editing is really fun. I'm not super good at it or anything, but it is very fun, and it's more on the fly creativity. Like, I can just be editing, and I think, oh hey, I think this clip would make for a good or maybe funny or kind of engaging little visual as I explain this point, and then I can add this animation and put this sound effect, and that will come out. I think that would come out really cool, and I can basically implement my idea within a matter of minutes. Whereas the writing, it's kind of like I'm considering the flow of the entire script, and it's a lot longer process. Anyhow, my process is passive research, directed research, writing, plus a little bit more research, and I guess you could say writing, editing, and then narration, and then video editing. And then after that, I guess you could say thumbnail creation, YouTube description, and what do you call it? Putting the tags and stuff like that. So anyhow, today I wanted to step into the writing process and tell you a little bit about what is going on in my head when I was writing. And it's not always the same, you know, method. I feel like someone like Stephen King might have a very specific method, very specific process that he uses for each book, just because he's so consistent. I mean, I have no idea what his process is, but he's just so impressively consistent that I wonder if he has some checklist or a very specific process that he goes through. So to give you some insight into what I do, I thought we could look at my most recent video, look at the nutrition science script, or the... Sorry, I already forgot what I titled it. Let me see. Pull that up, what I've learned. Nutrition. Yeah, why is nutrition science so complicated? Or if you look at the thumbnail, why is nutrition so gudetama fucking confusing? But the PDF is called Nutrition Science Script, which I'll attach to this post so you can follow along. And I hope it's easy to follow along, because I might be kind of jumping from paragraph to paragraph. And let me see, I guess to deal with that, it would be nice if I had a video where I could show you precisely where I'm pointing. But I think you can understand pretty much everything I'm saying without even looking at the script. But if you'd like to follow along, the script will be attached, and you can, I guess, control F. If it sounds like if you're not quite sure where I am. So I'll give you to lay this out a little bit better, to give you an outline of what I'm going to do, is I'll go through a couple paragraphs which I think show, which I think demonstrate some of the concepts that I try to have in mind, or the principles that I try to have in mind while I'm writing and while I'm editing. And I'll jump around, and I'm not going to go through the entire thing because that'd be far too long and probably get redundant after I've expressed the key principles. So I'll try to make it quick and, not quick, but concise. So let's just start from the top, which the script starts with, consider the following sequence of events, and then I get into the Okinawa story. So this story about Okinawa, how they had, or the sequence of events that I talk about here, this is something that I can talk off the top of my head pretty easily from a while back. And if people are interested in Okinawa or comes up in conversation, I've mentioned it to my friends a couple times. So it just kind of comes out the top of my head. But that doesn't mean I can just write it out and just kind of just write out the whole thing and be like, okay, great, have the paragraph done, now let's move on. I wrote it out, and then there was a lot of things that I had to confirm and go back and edit several parts of this. Actually, this took a while to, for something that I felt like I knew pretty well off the top of my head, this took a while to formulate this whole, I guess it's three paragraphs, these first three paragraphs where I'm explaining the situation with the Okinawa battle, the survey that was done 4 years after the battle, and then how recent articles are referring to that survey that was done pretty much right after the war. But anyhow, let me tell you why I picked this story to start the video. Let's say, for example, in the video I talk about eggs, and I'm scrolling down to page six, and I'm talking about how in a specific Japanese book, the author was explaining that according to a 2013 meta-analysis, those who ate more than one egg a day had 42% higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes than those who hardly ate eggs. And I think this very clearly explains the key concept that I want to express in this video, which is even when an article or a research paper can appear very scientific and very well thought out and gone through proper processes, you know, proper vetting processes to ensure that it is a very good piece of science, that is not always the case, and certain papers do not necessarily prove something, but they act as a piece of evidence, and that piece of evidence can be weaker or stronger. And then this egg study I thought was a great example, because at first it seems very like, if you're not familiar with the methods of that study, it seems like a very strong piece of evidence. It's like, okay, those who ate more than one egg a day had a 42% higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes. That's a very specific number. So they must have had very well-calibrated methods to find that out. And then, is that really the case? Let's take a look at how this study works. And I explain how it's an amalgam of three studies. They use more than that, but for the diabetes data, it was three studies. And if you take a look at those, there's flaws with each of these three studies. And meaning, while there's more data making it appear to be more accurate, thanks to the extra data or the larger amount of data, in fact, because there's more data, you're confounding it makes for an even more complicated, how should I put it? It makes it even more complicated to draw conclusions from all this data. But this is kind of dry, to be honest. It's like, okay, I start out with a number, 42% higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes. I don't think that really brings a clear picture to too many people's head. Like, okay, compared to what? Does that mean how quickly will I develop diabetes? You know, it's not personal. It's not really emotional. It's just very dry very dry number. And then I say, I introduce the concept of meta-analysis. I think most of y'all on my Patreon understand what a meta-analysis is. But some people are not. I think a fair share of the people who come and check out my video, they're not already into, very into health and digging through studies to find, like, what should I be eating, things like that. And then we get into wording, like, no statistically significant associations were found between egg consumption and diabetes. Still very dry, not very catching. And then I guess this area, this is kind of easier to understand, where I say the people eating the most eggs are smoking the most, eating higher amounts of trans fats, and eating 500 more calories per day. That's pretty clear. It's like, okay, yeah, those things would probably mess up the data. But at least in my opinion, I think this story is a bit dry. So I wanted to start with something more hooking, more engaging from the start. And this story of Okinawa, while I do use a lot of facts and figures, 1945, 82-day-long battle, 150,000 Okinawans, a third of the population. In 1945, this happened, and 85% of calories came from this. And 2016, there's a lot of facts and figures, but it's more of a story. And there's a lot more emotional engagement. At least for me, this story was... It's pretty emotionally gripping. I'm not Okinawan, but I think the whole concept of a land being devastated, and then when they are trying to, like, regain composure, so to speak, and regain their diet, then conclusions like, oh, when you had this terribly paltry diet, thanks to utter destruction of your land, we can assume that this is your traditional diet. When you look at it that way, it's kind of sad, but what I want to say is this is not the whole story. Anyways, that's not the whole story. It could be argued that 4 years was sufficient time for them to get back to a more traditional style diet, but my point is it's not the entire story. So let's rewind a bit. So I wanted to start with something that was more engaging, and I thought this Okinawa story was very engaging and interesting, while at the same time presents exactly the kind of concept or my thesis for the video. It is that there can be some articles or research papers that are very convincing, that make claims about health, but when you look closer at the situation, it's not always the entire story. And I thought this Okinawan story illustrated that very well. So now to get into the nitty-gritty of what I did, what I was doing as I was editing these paragraphs, because it took a while to put this together, I would say the first thing I needed to do was make sure I had all my facts and dates, facts and figures, make sure that they were all correct. Like 1945, I knew that much. I didn't really need to confirm that, but I needed to put a reference or a link for the script, because I make that available on the videos. So when was it? It was 1945. Okay, the battle was 82 days, and it was considered one of the bloodiest in the Pacific, and resulted in the death of almost 150,000 Okinawans. So I had to confirm this figure, 150,000, and then roughly a third. Actually, I had approximately a half of the population, but digging further, a third seemed more, or was more accurate based on a couple different sources, and I linked the source in the script. And then I have phrasing like, due to widespread destruction and foodstuffs in particular being stolen or deliberately destroyed, a huge number of civilians were left starving and struggled to return to a sufficient diet after the war. So deliberately destroyed. This is something that I had to confirm. I think I had to look it up in Japanese. They use this, what was it, kill... Anyways, that's... But I had to look that up and make sure that it was indeed the case that foodstuffs didn't happen to be destroyed, but actually there was deliberate destruction of the Okinawans' foodstuffs. And I think this was done... There was a large amount of foodstuffs donated by Taiwan to Okinawa. And then I think it was the Japanese army actually that destroyed the foodstuffs, or burned it. And then, so I had to confirm that. And you'll actually see that via Ryukyu Okinawashi, Okinawa, so via essentially this book in Japanese, page 264. And I wish I could make it available in English, but my source was in Japanese, so I just put that. It's actually the textbook used for middle school students in Okinawa when they're learning about Okinawan history. And then I say, a huge number of civilians were left starving and struggled to return to a sufficient diet after the war. So this is something that I played with the wording with a couple times, because okay, sorry, I'm jumping between concepts a little bit, but basically the first thing is I'm going to confirm all the facts and figures and make sure everything is accurate. Okay, and then the next thing is I'm going to mess with the wording, or fine-tune the wording, because I want to make things as concise as possible, and but at the same time deliver, well, to make it concise, I need to finesse the wording of certain phrases so that it will convey a specific point in less words. So, let me see. Yeah, nowhere in this paragraph is me saying that 4 years was not enough time for them to return to their sufficient diet. Before the survey in 1949 was done. So instead of saying something like, should we really expect that 4 years is enough time for a starving population who just had their land destroyed to return to their traditional diet? Like, instead of saying something like that, I just said a huge number of civilians were left starving and struggled to return to a sufficient diet after the war. So it's not as clear as what I just said, but it's implied, and I think conveys generally the same concept. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to do, is make my points more concise, especially at the start. I think it's good to deliver things quickly at the start of the video, but that's also something I'm keeping in mind throughout the entire editing process, is what do I want to say? Okay, how have I said it so far? This is during the editing process. How have I said it so far? Okay, can this be expressed differently? Can I tweak the wording in previous sentences or sentences following this in a way that I don't need to add that extra sentence? So instead of saying like a huge number of civilians were left starving, and yeah, I could say I could have just said a huge number of civilians were left starving, cut it there, and then add that thing like, but is 4 years really enough time for them to return to a sufficient diet after their foodstuffs and land was destroyed during the war? That's a bit longer, so if I just phrase it as I did here, then it makes it shorter. So for those of you who like to write or want to make an explainer video or want to, I think just writing in general, it's usually better to try and make your wording more concise. At least I've found that works for me and makes for more gripping, better flowing scripts. Okay, so skipping to the paragraph starting with Okinawan people did historically eat their fair share of sweet potatoes. This shows another good point, or another thing that I need, that I keep in mind while I'm writing. It's essentially, is I'm always thinking, can I say that? Or am I being too decisive here? Or am I being too, how should I put it? Yeah, am I being too decisive or too, I'm running out of words. Let's go with that. Let's go with the word decisive. So am I being too decisive? Like if I just leave it like that, like, okay, here's a sequence of events, and they were starving when the survey came out finding that they eat 85% of their calories from carbohydrates, and then this BBC article in 2019 refers to that survey and says a high carb diet may explain why Okinawans live so long. And then let's say I just right away said, when you dig in a bit, it becomes apparent that this BBC article lacks some very important context. So that would just cast a big shadow over the whole, or cast a lot of doubt over this idea that Okinawans had a high carb diet. And then people would be like, but, well, didn't they have a high carb diet? You know, maybe that was the case, but it doesn't necessarily prove that the traditional diet wasn't high carb. So it was appropriate to explain that, yes, they did eat their fair share of sweet potatoes, which is true, before the war. And why was that? Because the weather-resistant tuber, the typhoon-resistant tuber, was a good staple crop. It was a good, reliable source of calories. So my point is not to say... I added that caveat and added that information because my point is not to say, no, the Okinawan diet was not high carb, but the point is that it's not fair to make conclusions about Okinawans' longevity based on their diet during this time. So that was my point, more so than what is the carbohydrate content of the diet. So I think some people took it that way, more like, oh, hey, Okinawan people's diet is assuredly not high carb. You know, well, what are you going to do? That'll happen. But my point was more that, look, here's an instance of context being ignored when it's actually very important to consider when you're considering this data. So that's something that I'll often do. Like if I'm expressing something and I feel like my point could be misunderstood, then I'll add a caveat to clarify the point, or I will reword things to make it more appropriate. Or if I feel like I'm being too black and white about something, like, yes, Okinawans assuredly had a lower carb diet, then I'll tone that back a bit and add some qualifiers if necessary. Okay, so the next point I want to bring up about things I'm keeping in mind while I'm writing is... I try harder to make the video more engaging and interesting and easy to understand at the start of the video rather than in the middle of it. So what I mean by that is, for example, let's say I have some pretty difficult concepts and I have to introduce new jargon and use some statistics or explain some biochemical process, this kind of dry things, which most of the time, the only time I bring it up is if I think it's important to know or is important to explain what I'm trying to explain, then of course I want to convey this in the video. But I try to keep it later in the video after the audience is engaged to a certain degree. Otherwise, they will... how do I put it? otherwise, they're not going to be engaged enough to want to sit through that. It takes patience and mental energy to sit through that, these kind of things when you're learning new concepts. So I try to balance it. And what I will do, it's sort of like in a movie. Let's say there's a very tense movie. If it's just tense throughout the entire movie, you can kind of feel uncomfortable and not, it's harder to enjoy the movie and relax. Some movies are just tense throughout the entire thing. But you'll also see some comedic relief. Like the movie's very tense, but then they'll throw in a scene with comedic relief, and then you can relax, and then they'll get back to the more tense stuff. So that's kind of what I try to do here. So I make it interesting, engaging, doesn't take too much mental investment to understand what I'm explaining, and then I'll introduce some more technical points, make the audience exercise more patience and mental energy to understand what I'm saying. And then I'll try to, once again, relieve them of that pressure by talking about concepts that are kind of like, don't need too much explanation, are interesting, easy to understand, maybe kind of fun, things like that. So what I'm doing here, first, I thought this story about Okinawa was pretty interesting and very easy to understand, and then I jump into a easy to understand analogy, which I think kind of highlights the concept I'm trying to, or highlights the concept I'm trying to explain throughout the video. Basically, you should look at pieces of evidence or studies that support such and such health claims as just one piece of evidence of many. And these pieces of evidence can be strong or weak. And it's like clues, like when a detective is looking at clues and saying, okay, based on all the evidence I've looked at, it seems John killed the butler, or sorry, the butler killed John. By the way, this analogy came from my friend Eli Lyons, the person who showed up in the video, which I thought was a really good analogy, so use that. And then along with this idea of let's make stuff easier to understand at the start of the video, I introduced this book, The Best Diet, Simple and Evidence-Based Guide to Healthy Eating. And then I thought, so this is a little dry. It's not super interesting to bring up a book that is saying, you know, it's not an interesting, fun anecdote, but I thought it was easy enough to understand. For example, he's saying butter is a bad fat as shown by several studies. Okay, so what is the evidence he has to support this? And then let's go to the reference, and maybe if we check out the reference that is affixed to this statement, then it will give us some really strong evidence. But then actually, if you go back to the reference, it's just a footnote. It says the idea that butter is bad comes from observational studies, blah, blah, blah. However, the evidence that butter intake affects your risk for disease is not particularly strong. So this again adds to my point, but it's easy to understand. I don't need to pick apart his study because the author said himself that the evidence that butter intake affects your risk for diabetes is not particularly strong. And then what I did next is I wanted to talk about eggs, but I thought it was still too early to bring up this egg point, because in order to make my point with eggs and show how, for example, in this book, he says you should limit your egg intake to only one a day. And then what does he base it on? He bases it on this study. Okay, let's pick apart that study. That study's a meta-analysis. It uses these three papers. Here's the wording in those papers. And then da-da-da. That's a little drier. And I don't think is appropriate to come at the start of the video, because it takes more mental investment to get through what I'm trying to explain. So what I do is I bring up the eggs, because I'm going to talk about it later. Actually, I thought eggs was something that I've had several different people message me or comment, what about eggs? Should I be eating eggs? What about this recent study? So I kind of wanted, it was kind of a cliffhanger to let people know I'm going to get back to this egg thing. But because the explanation behind the eggs was a little dry, I just cut it off there and said, we'll get back to this egg idea later. I said we'll talk about how this affected him in a moment. We'll come back to the evidence for this egg claim, but first I need to explain a couple of concepts. Okay, and I threw in that 88-year-old man anecdote story because it's fun and it's easy to get a mental image of what's going on. Okay, this 88-year-old dude, he's been eating 25 eggs a day for 15 years. So what happened to him? And it's a lot more engaging than the meta-analysis, I think. But I cut it off there because, like I said, I think the exploration of that egg concept, or at least what was going on in that book, was a little dry. And then the next thing, I want to explain the concept of confounding variables. So I found a pretty good headline. I think I saw this on someone's Twitter a while back. Like, it had just came up. And then the person said, like, oh, look at this new study. Anyhow, so this one didn't need too much explanation. So again, I thought this was appropriate for the start of the video, and it explains my concept of confounding variables. And it's just, you know, you have this headline, high-fat diet linked to anxiety and depression, which have people say, oh, shit, I shouldn't eat a lot of fat because then I'll get anxiety and depression. But then you see that the diet contains 20% protein, 45% fat, and 35% carbohydrate, with half of the carbohydrate being refined table sugar, and by weight, there's almost as much pure sugar as there is fat. Okay, so I think that's pretty, it doesn't need too much explanation. I think most people could say, okay, well, you know, fat isn't really isolated, so it's more accurate to say high-fat, high-sugar diet linked to anxiety, depression. That didn't need too much explanation. So this, again, goes along with my idea of let's not ask the audience to invest too much mentally at the very start of the video. Okay. And then the next thing I do is I want to, well, I want to expand upon this point of trying to isolate the effects of one thing or another, and that this is a common issue in biology when you're studying biology. And so then I have my friend Eli explain this. And so while Eli is still explaining some sort of complicated topics or complicated points, you know, he's talking about oncogenes and how mutation in gene A or gene B might have more of an effect than this or that on the driving cancer. It's a little complicated. It takes a little bit of mental investment. But I thought because I'm introducing a new dynamic. Sorry, one moment. Okay, so because I'm introducing a new dynamic, I'm going from my typical style, explaining concepts while showing animations and clips, to an interview style where you actually see a person talking. I thought that was enough of a shift in dynamic to keep people engaged while some more complicated points are explained. Then we have the Benjamin Bickman point. Let's see, I'm on page 5 now, where Benjamin Bickman is explaining this study in canines. And I use the insulin, protein does not always affect insulin, and it depends on the context point to make my point. And there was a caveat that you'll find in the script. I left it in the script, but I didn't end up actually reading it off or actually saying it in the video because actually I added this caveat into the script after I finished the narration, and I was planning to tweak the narration later and add this caveat. But let me explain why I put that caveat there and why I didn't think it was necessary to make sure and go back and add that to the video. So the caveat is, so I explained, the dogs not receiving glucose did not see their insulin change to any noticeable degree. And then I added, there's still more to be said about how different types of protein in different diets affect not only insulin, but glucagon, a hormone that works counter to insulin. But for now, imagine how this fact could confuse the data in an example of study, blah, blah, blah. And that's actually in the script. In the video, I mean. So I added this point about insulin and glucagon because I wasn't 100% sure if it is always the case that protein does not affect insulin in the context of low carbohydrate or low glucose. So because I wasn't totally sure about that, I added this caveat, and Benjamin Bickman explains all this really well in his talk. But because I'm not saying I didn't say anything definitive like, so we can throw out this worry about protein on a low carb diet. We can disregard that. I don't make any conclusion like that. My point is just that, look, the context, at least in this study, the context affects how the amino acid alanine affects insulin. So imagine how such a fact, actually that would have been better wording, imagine how such a fact or a fact like this would confuse the data in, for example, blah, blah, blah. But because I'm just saying, imagine how this fact would confuse the data in, for example, a study looking at how protein affects risk for diabetes and insulin-driven disease. That's my point, is these kind of caveats or these kind of situations where context is very important on how a certain compound will affect a hormone in the body, consider how this might not be taken into account when a study is designed to look at diabetes risk. So that's my point. My point isn't to say low-carb dieters don't worry about protein, but again, it goes with my whole point of like, here's why nutrition science can be so complicated. So I didn't think it was necessary to go and explicitly make sure I have this caveat in the video. Okay, here's one more thing. I think this started, when does Dave Feldman come in?
Patient to eat on- low.
Dave Feldman comes in. Dave Feldman comes in around 8 minutes and 30 seconds. So people have been watching for already 8 minutes and 30 seconds, but I kind of wanted to stick with this idea of let's require less mental effort for the start of the video. I wanted to apply that to the first 10 minutes or so of the video. So what I did when Dave Feldman came in, and I think the concept Dave was explaining was a little harder to understand because I'm trying to say like, well, I introduced three biomarkers, and depending on the person, they might be familiar with those already: LDL, HDL, triglycerides, you know, bad cholesterol, good cholesterol, triglycerides. But there was something about this concept that I thought was complicated enough that it was necessary to reiterate certain things. So while before I was going for brevity and trying to be very concise with my wording, I thought it was appropriate to kind of re-explain or emphasize and repeat these concepts. So actually, I expressed this concept, or the Dave and I expressed this concept three times. So the concept is LDL is not as... Okay, had to close my hallway door as the construction site next door wanted to start jackhammering. But the concept that I'm introducing is that LDL is not as important, or not nearly as important as we would think, if it is in the context of high HDL and low triglycerides. So I don't think there's something about that where it's a little more abstract, I guess. Because let's say, for example, blood volume. Like, if your blood volume is high, it makes you exercise better. Something like that. I feel like that paints an easier picture. Like, okay, if you have a lot of blood, then you can, like, move energy. Or, you know, you have more blood to fuel your muscles, so that makes you exercise better. I feel like that's an easier concept to catch on. But if I'm saying, okay, you know, there's these three markers. We all know one of them is or assumed to be very important to heart disease risk. But there's these other two that are often overlooked and actually they're more important than this marker. Like, what does LDL look like? You know, I don't think most people have a clear image of, like, this is what LDL looks like. Or if they were shown a picture of what is the concept of LDL or conceptualization of LDL picture, illustration, I don't think people would immediately think of that. So it's kind of harder to... My point is it's harder to get a clear picture in mind when I say this concept. So it's actually explained three times in this segment. I say, Dave explained the logic behind when it comes... The logic behind why when it comes to heart disease, LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, isn't all that important in the context of high HDL and low triglycerides. So there we go. I introduced the concept. And then Dave himself says it. He says, the NHANES data has certainly been exciting, blah, blah, blah. If you look at LDL by itself, when you look at it grouped with high HDL and low triglycerides, it's associated with low mortality. So there it is again. And then Dave introduces the data supporting this that essentially explains the same thing. The first two times, it's kind of like to try and make the concept clearer. And then I think at that point, when he says higher LDL is associated with lower mortality, that might have people think, wait, what? Really? That's totally different from what I've always been told. So it's, of course, necessary to give some justification. And so Dave has this huge data set that shows this. And it's not just... So earlier, he explained the logic behind it. So there's some logic behind it, but does it really come out in the data? And yes, it does. So that's that part. Okay, so this whole thing about LDL, HDL, and triglycerides with Dave Feldman ends right around the 10-minute mark, I think. And so that just hit my little, what do you want to call it? So the start of the video really needs to be engaging and interesting and quick. That solved that first 10 minutes. So now I can introduce something sort of drier and maybe not as fun as the other things, which is the egg thing. So I finally come back to the egg point. And then I break down the meta-analysis. So get people to invest a little bit more mental energy in that. That's explained. And then I wrap up and explain what happened with the 88-year-old. He had no health complaints other than poor memory and loneliness. And then, okay, so I had just introduced that, you know, this egg point that I thought was a bit dry. And then I want to come back and introduce now, go from a harder concept to an easier concept. Okay, so my segue into talking about animal models is, of course, the other reason for us being told not to eat eggs comes from the theory that fat and cholesterol cause heart disease. Most people are familiar with that. It doesn't need much explanation. And then the first clue for this theory comes from this research by Nikolai Anishkov. I don't think too many people have heard of him. Anishkov found that feeding cholesterol to rabbits had them develop very high levels of blood cholesterol and atherosclerosis. People would think, okay, yeah, that's in line with this fat and cholesterol cause heart disease, so it makes sense that was I could see why that would be the first clue. Doesn't need too much explanation. And then I say, but rabbits are herbivores, so their natural intake of cholesterol hovers right around 0 milligrams. So here's my point, is there's a flaw in how this idea started because of the nature of rabbits. And then, so I thought that this whole idea, it's kind of interesting because I'm introducing a new person and I'm telling you where fat and cholesterol cause heart disease, where that idea came from. And I don't think too many people are familiar with Nikolai Anishkov being the first clue, so it's kind of like, oh, hey, I didn't know that. Interesting. And it's easy to understand. And then it acts as my segue to get into my next point. And then Eli explains how the mice using experience are not very diverse. And then I supplement. So Eli introduced this point about the breeds not being very diverse, and then to supplement that and give an interesting little story to illustrate that, I explain the Lewis doll thing. And then Eli gives his. He explains more about the problems with model organisms, and then I interject again, and then he explains a bit more, and then I get into my more difficult point. Okay, so this stuff here, the interview with Eli, and then my point about Lewis Dahl, it's leading up to this a little bit more complicated concept of how mice's metabolism is different from humans, to where a low-carb diet for a human is different from that of what would constitute a low-carb diet for a mouse. I think that's a relatively complex concept. So I thought this lead-up was appropriate to kind of ease the audience into, you know, talking about these little drier, more complex points. Which this is all going in line with my idea of I need to balance the complex stuff with easier to understand, more engaging, more interesting stuff, or more things that don't need too much explanation, don't require too much mental effort. Okay. After that, I think that pretty much covers the concepts I wanted to talk about when I was writing this script specifically. But yeah, this point is something I'm thinking about a lot. Is the information, the complex information I'm presenting, being balanced enough with interesting and engaging or simpler information? And sometimes I will even have a script ready and I'll read through it and I'll say like, okay, I'm presenting three concepts in a row that are semi-difficult and they're not balanced with an interesting anecdote or some bit of relief. You know, there's no anecdote, maybe I don't really rely on jokes too much. I'll just kind of slip them in if they fit somewhere. But yeah, I'll actually be editing, think I'm done with this script, and then I'll have three complex topics presented in a row. And so then I'll actually go out and look. I'll try and remember some anecdote that relates to that, or even try and look up one. And if there's some interesting anecdote, I'll slip it in there. Or I might, if I can't do that, then I will try and simplify, but make the concepts, the presentation of those concepts quicker. So if I can't at least balance it with something interesting and engaging, or if I can't find any, and then if I can't find anything interesting or engaging enough, then I might even simplify the concept or consider removing it if I think it's not entirely necessary to make the point I'm making, or I'll just try and make the explanation shorter so that, let's say it's, you know, some people get kind of lost when I'm explaining the concept. I'm explaining something, they're like, wait, what's he talking about? I don't quite get that. Then we've moved on enough that they can be engaged for the next concept. And what I'm often doing is I try to make my point using multiple concepts or multiple studies. So if one person is like, I didn't quite get that point, then they'll get the next two, and it'll still be sufficient to get to the point I'm trying to make. I hope that's clear enough. Okay, so to wrap up, I think that's about it. I think that's everything I wanted to express. Basically, as I'm writing, I'm trying to keep it interesting, trying to make everything accurate, and I do it, and I try and keep it accurate by confirming my facts and figures, and if I ever have a point, I try and make sure that it is backed up with a study, that you can find a link in the script. Or I'll put some caveat when I feel like it's not safe to say what I'm saying as black and white as the way I put it. I'll tone down the wording or introduce a caveat. And then, other than that, the other basic thing I'm doing is just try and word everything in less words. You know, if you can get a concept across quicker, I think that's better. And it keeps people engaged. They're less likely to be bored while listening or reading your content. If you're doing a blog post, I think you have more room to be more wordy and maybe be a lot more thorough with the way you introduce concepts, because if let's say you're explaining something and people are reading this on your blog post, they can kind of be like, oh, okay, yeah, I got that. I already know that. So let me skip down to the next paragraph. They have that flexibility, so it seems more appropriate in a blog post. And the reason, I don't mean to sound like I'm just saying, here's how to optimize for getting people to watch your video as long as possible. That's one thing I'm doing. Of course, that's great. I want people to watch the entire video. It's good for my, what do you call it, YouTube stats, or works with the algorithm really well. But at the same time, there's something I want to express and that I think that is important for people to know. And if I can't, let's say the way I presented it is not the most thorough, it's not the most thorough way to present it, that is surely the case for several, probably all of my videos. It's not as thorough as it could be. Like, most of these topics I talk about you could write a book on each one. But what I'm trying to do is get concepts across to people, because I think that's important for them and it could help them. So I need to stay engaging enough that they want to stick around and actually listen to it. Because I could have the best information in the world, but if I can't present it in a way that is interesting and engaging, then it doesn't really matter. So that's why I'm very concerned about how engaging and how interesting my presentation is. So I think, that is everything that I wanted to express here. So that will conclude the podcast. If y'all have any questions or would like for me to clarify something, just leave a comment on the Patreon post and I'll try to get back to it. And also give me some feedback on, if you don't mind, give me some feedback on this format. Was it helpful? Did it seem appropriate to talk about, you know, to analyze my writing process in a podcast form? Things like that. Or was there something I could have done that would have made this better or easier for you to extract my points better? Let me know in the Patreon post. Thanks.